Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Do you have a hunger for cinematic horror?
Do you enjoy the thrill from seeing boogeymen, beasts, and butchers go about their dark work?
Then all you need to do is speak of the devil, and the devil will come to you.
Speak of the Devil is a podcast for all movies that have anything from demons and poltergeists to serial killers and the supernatural.
I'm Kayla.
And I'm Taylor.
Join us as we embark on a journey through the dark recesses of horror films, from the classics to blockbusters and everything in between.
New episodes come out every Wednesday wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're not scared of anything.
Are you?
What's up, frickin' weirdos?
My name is Kevin, and I'm the host of Where the Weird Ones Are podcast. This is a conversational podcast based on guest experiences and encounters with paranormal, cryptids, aliens, spirituality, mental health, as well as conspiracies. If these topics interest you, you can find me on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, as well as YouTube and Rumble. If you have an encounter or an experience of something that you can't quite explain, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to me at wheretheweirdonesare@gmail.com. where_theweirdonesare on Instagram, and Where the Weird Ones Are on Facebook. I hope to hear from you, my friends. Question everything and stay weird.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Welcome back, everyone, to our fun, brutal, bizarre, and boozy podcast. Happy to have you joining us again.
Yeah, it's always good to hang out with you guys. Thanks for checking in once again.
How are you doing today, Declan?
Oh, I'm good. It's Super Bowl weekend, so that's exciting.
Yeah. We're trying to decide if we're going to even watch the game. Because we don't care about the Chiefs.
I'm going to watch it because I want to see the Chiefs lose, but other than that. And the commercials are always good, but.
That's why it was funny, because your dad asked me if I wanted to watch the game. And I go, you know, I don't care about either of these teams. He goes, neither do I. But the commercials, we could watch for the commercials. So I think we're going to watch for the commercials and play board games or something instead.
Nice.
Yeah. What story are you going to be telling us today?
I'm going to talk about Mad Hatter Syndrome.
Oh, I like it.
Yes, it's very interesting. What are you going to be telling us about today?
Well, I am going to be telling you about a family murder. So.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. That's not good.
But I forgot to mention before we get started that we had a new Apple Podcast review that was really nice, and I wanted to read it out. It's 5 stars, titled "So Fun!" exclamation point, from the B Trio. This podcast offers a captivating blend of true crime and the paranormal, all while sharing themed cocktails. Jane and Declan's engaging storytelling and unique mother-son dynamic make each episode a must-listen. Highly recommended for fans of the macabre and mixology. So thanks
Nice play on words.
Yeah, to the B Trio for giving us a fun little review. Appreciate it very much.
Yes.
So to go back to our story, to my story, my family murder story, pretty popular family murder story is the Menendez family and the Menendez brothers. So.
I was thinking about doing that one, but there's just so much information on it that.
There is a lot of information.
I didn't feel like doing it.
I tried to pare it down a little bit rather than getting into the minutiae of like this happened and then that happened and this happened again and then that happened. So it's going to be more of an overview and we can talk about viewpoints and theories and stuff like that. But before we get into the story, I have the cocktail that I chose for this is the Old Cuban, and it is 3/4 ounce lime juice, 1 ounce of simple syrup, 6 to 8 mint leaves, 1.5 ounces of aged rum, 2 dashes of Angostura bitters, 2 ounces of sparkling wine, and then a garnish with either a lime wedge or a mint sprig. And the steps are to add the lime juice and simple syrup to a cocktail shaker with mint leaves. Muddle them well. Then add your rum and bitters, top with ice, and shake well. Then double strain into a chilled cocktail glass and top with your sparkling wine and your garnish, if you're using a garnish. So.
It almost sounds like a mojito.
Very similar. Yes.
But I think mojito uses sparkling water instead of wine, right?
I don't think a mojito even has either in it. Oh. So I liked the name, so that's why I chose the drink. I don't know if I'll like the drink because it's rum, but I think
we'll find out. Anything great.
Right. Are you ready? Let's give it
a little
sample. So, yes, it does taste very mojito-y, but that sparkling wine changes it just a little bit.
Yeah.
And makes it, it's not terrible. Yeah. And, of course, it makes it dry, which I'm not a huge fan of dry drinks, but I like it because of the mint. And
yeah, a little refreshing.
It's not too sweet. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I would drink this and I would recommend it. It's a good drink, especially if you like mojitos. It's a little different take on a mojito. So are you ready for the Menendez family?
Yeah, let me have it.
Okay. On August 20th, 1989, Lyle Menendez called 911 to emotionally report that someone had killed his parents. The operator was surprised by the call and asked Lyle what had happened and if the killers were still there. Police arrived on the grisly scene to find Lyle and his brother Eric at the home of their parents, who had been brutally shot, multiple times by shotguns as well. So the investigators said that this scene was gory, super gory.
Yeah, that's a big splatter on the wall.
Yeah, there was discussion. I watched a documentary about it. One of the investigators discussed how, like, brain matter was in a lot of places and brains were falling out.
Well, at least it went quick, I guess.
Ooh, yeah. So police arrived on the grisly scene to find Lyle and his brother Eric at the home. Oh, wait, I already said that. Lyle suggested to investigators that the crime may have had some mob motivation. He didn't really say what, but he led them to believe that there was some mafia entanglement with their dad. Lyle said that.
Okay.
Lyle is the oldest brother. We'll get into their ages and things. Neither Lyle nor Eric were considered or treated as suspects in the horrific murder, which in hindsight was kind of a big mistake, because obviously they ended up being the suspects and convicted. Spoiler alert, but if you didn't know they were convicted, then you might be under a rock. But at the time, they weren't considered at all. So police didn't do any gunshot testing on their hands. They were very polite. They were cordial. It might have also played a factor that this was in Beverly Hills, which is a very ritzy, expensive neighborhood, and not something that you would expect to see that kind of gory crime, certainly not by family members. So I think they just were like, these poor kids found something terrifying. Going back, let's talk about the family. The patriarch of the family was Jose Menendez, born May 6, 1944 in Havana, Cuba, which is why I picked this drink called the Old Cuban. He and his family left Cuba when he was 16 years old due to the revolution occurring in Cuba at the time. His family was affluent for that area and for the time, but moving to the U.S. changed that. They were basically starting over. However, Jose didn't let that keep him down. He attended college, where he met Mary Louise Anderson, who went by the nickname Kitty. She was a few years older than Jose.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
But the couple were soon married. Jose earned an accounting degree and eventually started working for some pretty big companies. Their firstborn son was Joseph Lyle, who went by Lyle. He was born in 1968. Their second son, Eric, was born in 1970. Jose worked in New York, and for several years, the family lived nearby in New Jersey. For a while, Jose worked as a top executive for the Hertz Car Rental Company. He left Hertz to work as an executive for RCA Records, a recording group responsible for many of the top musical artists. When he was appointed as the CEO of Live Entertainment Company, the family moved to California, eventually moving into a mansion in the opulent neighborhood of Beverly Hills. Appearances were important to Jose. He especially wanted Lyle and Eric to be the best at everything, including like sporting and academics. And he was kind of cruel about it at times and making them like they were into tennis, but they couldn't play against anyone that Jose considered to be a lesser athlete. So he would only pair them against other children that were better than them, which, I mean, I get the point behind that, but, you know, at some point you have to kind of just let things go and let them work on their stuff, but whatever. Lyle went away to college, attending Princeton University in New Jersey for a short time, but eventually he was kicked out of school. Eric was still at home and going to high school. He was a pretty good tennis player, reaching a ranking of 44th in the country for the junior division. After graduating, he intended to go north to attend college several hours away. However, that never came to fruition, which was one of the explanations during the trial as to why this happened. He wanted to go away, and his dad said, no, you're not going anywhere. You're going to stay here. And that spiraled into all of the events. Just a few months after Eric graduated high school, the parents would be dead, and the boys were essentially orphans. So not only did dad say, you're not moving away to college, but then the brothers ended up doing their thing and the parents ended up dead and he still didn't go away to college. Mm-hmm. In a few weeks, Lyle
received,
what's that?
You might've already said this, but I'm guessing he received a decent chunk of change for their father's death.
They did. We're going to get to that kind of money here in just a couple seconds. Because it was a few weeks, you know, a couple months or so after the parents died that they came into that huge chunk of change, in which was to the tune of $650,000 life insurance policy.
And what is that? Today,
I don't, you know, normally I look it up, but this time I didn't look it up.
When was it again?
80s?
1989. 650,000.
650,000.
Yep. That is
$1.654 million. Okay. I was thinking close to a million. I didn't think it would necessarily be over. So that's a good chunk of change for when you're 18 and 21 years old.
Yeah, good amount. Nothing to scoff at.
I wouldn't mind seeing that right now. Okay. Not long after the deaths of their parents, the brothers spent a lot of money to the tune of about $700,000. So
they got 6.5 and spent seven.
They got $6,500 and they spent $700,000. Yeah.
Okay.
Which, of course, was a pretty big, gigantic red flag for a lot of people, especially the police, because others, including extended family, claimed, you know, I shouldn't say that the police thought that, outsiders thought that, but the family stuck by Lyle and Eric. They were like, no, these boys did not kill their parents. This was not something that they would have done. And that spending habits of $700,000 in a few weeks, they said it was pretty common. So friends and family were saying those Lyle and Eric were used to spending.
What'd they spend it on? Do you know?
Yes. So they bought some Rolex watches. I believe it was three of them. Lyle bought a restaurant back in New Jersey and as well as a sports car. What's that? Yeah, he was an investor. He was trying to turn his money around. He had to think long term, and so why not buy a restaurant?
What car did he buy?
A Porsche Carrera sports car.
Porsche Carrera. Yeah, I'd do that too.
Same.
Yeah, that's a good, same. Good pick.
They also took a lot of expensive trips overseas, and Eric hired a tennis coach so that he could continue competing, including internationally. So not all of those trips were just sightseeing trips. They were also Eric going over to compete in tennis matches. They eventually moved out of the mansion in Beverly Hills and bought condos near each other in a nearby town. They were sole heirs to the family fortune. Nobody else is in line to get the money. There was some discussion about that. Obviously, you know, the theory was that they did this for money, but they would have gotten money either way.
I'm sure they had a hefty allowance.
They're the sole heirs. There's a mansion in Beverly Hills. I did not find anywhere how much it said that mansion was worth, but it's Beverly Hills, so you know it's not going to be cheap.
Well, they had lots of money. Yeah.
Right. So even though they got $650 in life insurance money, they still had all of the assets and property and everything that their parents owned that would have, you know, come to them through the death anyway. Lyle and Eric seemingly went on with their lives for months, almost 7 months exactly. After the deaths, Lyle was arrested for the murders. Eric was out of town at the time, but turned himself into the police a few days later. Based on the spending habits of both brothers, the police suspected the motive was money. Not a big stretch to think that. Totally makes sense. Family stood by the boys, claiming both were innocent of the charges. It took a while for the case to fully head into court. There was a lot of legal wrangling that took place before it could actually go to trial. It was learned that Eric had confessed to his psychologist, Jerome Oziel, that his brother, he said, my brother and I are responsible for the murders. Which, as a therapist, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, anything, should have been protected. And I don't know exactly why that information wasn't protected.
Well, isn't there a rule that if they hurt someone that they have to tell the police or something? Mm-hmm. I thought that was like, if maybe you're planning on hurting yourself or someone else, they have to tell the police.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's the reason why the psychologist ended up testifying in court. The psychologist also told his girlfriend at the time that Eric had confessed. And so that ended up getting pulled into court. She was called as a witness saying, he told me this information. But Oziel had been taping Eric's therapy sessions. And the court initially ruled the tapes would be admissible at court. And this is part of what delayed the trial from starting, because that ruling to allow the tapes in was appealed, and it delayed the trial for 2 more years.
Because, I mean, if he says, yeah, we did it, but then that was only 30 seconds of the tape, then the rest of the tape is probably HIPAA stuff that they can't talk about.
I would think so.
So that makes sense.
Right. The tapes did end up getting admitted, but the tape discussing the murders was excluded. So they allowed all the other stuff in except for that one piece. The trial began in 1993 and lasted several months. The trials were conducted simultaneously, but with separate juries for each brother. It was broadcast on court TV, which was one of the first like big trials that was put on court TV, and it was on there constantly. And because of all that coverage, because of the affluent family, because of the gore and the crimes and all of that, it became a lot of constant information in the news that, you know, comedians were talking about it, TV shows were talking about it. It was referenced a lot. So, I mean, that can be problematic when you're trying to give defendants a fair trial when it's constantly being talked about. That wasn't actually anything that came up as to impairing the trial. At least it wasn't in the sources that I watched and read. But Lyle and Eric didn't deny that they killed their parents, but they claimed it was done in self-defense. One of the biggest speed bumps in the self-defense claim, though, was the fact that the brothers had purchased the shotguns used in the murders just 2 days prior.
Yeah, that seems a little suspicious.
Exactly. It makes the argument that the murders were not in self-defense, but were premeditated because they, well, if you thought to go buy some guns, then you must have been planning something. And therefore, it couldn't have been self-defense.
Yeah.
I get that.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Argument. The problem was that what the basic defense strategy was, which was that both Lyle and Eric admitted to everyone in court and to family, because family was there supporting them and trying to, you know, help them, that they had been not only physically abused by both parents, but also their father had sexually abused them since childhood. Lyle testified that his...
For this?
What?
Is there any evidence for this?
Well, a little, actually.
Okay.
And we'll get into that. Lyle testified that his abuse only lasted 2 years and started when he was 6 years old. Eric testified that the abuse started in his childhood, his early childhood, and continued until just before the murders. One of their cousins also testified to the abuse and explained that she had told Kitty about it, but Kitty only accused Lyle of lying. So this is where that extra piece of evidence comes in, where the cousin said when they were 7, 8 years old, she learned of it. So it's not something that she had just heard about. She said she'd known about it for a long time, but because their mom didn't react to it, she didn't know what to do. You know, she's a little kid, didn't know what to do, so just left it alone. But she did testify to that in court. So the problem was, though, that both brothers claimed that their mother had known about it for a long time but done nothing to stop it. But the prosecution said that the sexual abuse was all falsified. They thought it was a big fake story because it had taken months for either defendant to make the claim. So the whole time they're saying, oh gosh, the mob must have killed our parents, and they were actually the victims of sexual abuse, instead of saying, yeah, we did it because we were tired of it. And Eric's main story and his rationale was that he wanted to go away to college, but his dad said, no, you can't go. You have to stay here. And he told his brother, and then the whole self-defense thing of, well, dad's going to keep doing this to me. Mom won't help me. I wanted to get away. And if I tell anyone, mom and dad are going to come after us, because remember, Jose is all about appearances and no one should know. So well, it just depends.
I guess it would make sense why they wouldn't come out. I'm reading a book to later do a podcast about the book, but it's about things like that. And it's, victims are often very reluctant to come out about abuses like that. So
for
it makes
sure.
sense that it didn't come out just straight away.
Right.
But,
especially back then.
Yeah.
Especially back then. This is the late 80s. And the abuse had been happening since the 70s. That kind of stuff was not mainstream talked about at all. Today's different.
Under the rug, if it was.
Exactly. Exactly. So that whole concept of we were sexually abused and we were tired of, Eric especially was tired of being the victim, and then Dad wouldn't let him go. So they were worried that the parents would do something to them, thus resulting in the self-defense claim. The tape therapy sessions that delayed the trial for 2 years was used by the prosecution to further discredit the claims of abuse. Because in the tapes, there had been no discussion of any sexual abuse, but Lyle and Eric did talk about how controlling Jose was and how Kitty had been suicidal. So there's that, well, did it happen or did it not happen kind of mentality. The trial concluded, leaving the decision up to the juries, but they were hopelessly deadlocked. They deliberated this for a month before they went to the judge and said, we cannot come to a decision.
Wow. That's a long...
It's a long time. A long time.
Yeah.
So the trial was ended and it was ruled a mistrial. The DA was like, immediately, we're trying them again. We're going forward with another trial. Basically, the women of the juries, they wanted to convict them of manslaughter instead of first-degree murder, but all of the male jurors kept insisting, no, we're convicting them for first-degree murder, and that's what ended it in a mistrial. It was completely gender-divided.
Is not even close to what happened. Murder in self-defense, but you can't accidentally shoot two people in the head with a shotgun, like, purposefully.
Right.
Like, that's dumb. Okay.
A second trial began in 1995, but this was a very different trial. The trial was no longer allowed to be broadcast on TV, with the judge stating it would allow the jurors to get outside information. So at the time, the first trial, they were like, put it on TV, we don't care. And then the judge was like, yeah, maybe we shouldn't do that because we just want the juries focusing on the information provided in the trial. That's the whole point of making sure that juries don't know the details of the crime ahead of time or during, and why some juries are sequestered, because they don't want anybody knowing outside speculation and somebody, you know, the neighbor down the street's story, any of that. Most importantly, though, there was very little testimony given regarding the sexual abuse, and Lyle didn't testify at all. In the first trial, both brothers testified on their own behalves. This one, only Eric did, and he wasn't really allowed to talk much about the sexual abuse. Testimony was given that Lyle had attempted to bribe an ex-girlfriend to make false statements about Jose, and that he had asked another friend to lie during the first trial. So they're making it look like Lyle is trying to negotiate things behind the scenes, which painted him in a bad light, and he didn't testify, so he couldn't say anything to defend himself in that regard. The defense, of course, disputed both of the testimonies of these statements as false allegations. In the end, Lyle and Eric were convicted of the murders and sentenced to life in prison without parole. Initially, they were placed in different prisons, but eventually were moved to the same prison. They now see each other regularly. Several jurors from the first trial believe that if the second trial juries had been allowed to hear the same testimony, there would have been a different outcome because of the whole, the first trial focused on victimology and sexual abuse, and the second trial didn't have hardly any of that in there. So they think that the first trial juries were like, nah, I think if they had heard the information, they would have changed that verdict or done something different. Lyle and Eric's case has found a recent resurgence in public interest, with many people claiming the sentencing was too harsh based on the allegations of sexual abuse. In fact, the LA County prosecutor even supported resentencing. However, the judge gave the incoming DA time to review the case material, so no decision has been made yet, which I thought was kind of weird. I tried looking this up to see what the decision was on the resentencing, because that was supposed to have happened January 30th of this year, and I could not find any information that it has come to conclusion that they have done anything different. So I don't know. It will probably come out within, you know, maybe a month or so is my guess that something has changed. But as of right now, the day that we're recording this, there has not been a decision on any resentencing for either brother.
Weird. And it's such big news. If there was anything, that it'd be all over every news outlet.
Yeah. And there was a lot of information, because the appeal on the resentencing was, I believe, filed in October of 2024. And then in November, the judge ruled that the incoming DA, they were postponing that decision until January of 2025 so that the incoming DA could review everything. But there wasn't anything in the news about that had been pushed out farther again. So I don't know. But it's some interesting information. It's an interesting idea that they would be resentenced, because that doesn't, I don't know that that happens like ever, but culturally, yeah, things have changed since then. So
true.
Yeah.
Okay. Let us talk about the Mad Hatter syndrome.
Yes. I feel like I'm going crazy already.
So one of the characters in Alice in Wonderland was a man named the Hatter, but is commonly known as the Mad Hatter due to his irregular behavior. While this is just a character in a fairy tale, his origins are rooted in an actual disease that plagued hat makers in the 18th and 19th centuries. In the 1800s, hats were made by taking the pelt of an animal, usually consisting of beaver, camel.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Vicuna, rabbits, or otters, with beaver pelt being the most luxurious. The pelts were felted, shaped, and then dyed. Felting required the fur being separated from the skin of the animal and matted together. After this, it was carotid, or soaked in an orange solution of mercury salts and nitric acid, to help smooth out the felt they had created. After being carotid, the pelts would be shrunk in boiling water and shaped into the desired shape using a wooden mold. While the felt dried on the molds, it would release mercury vapors into the often small, unvented hatter workshops. As we know today, mercury is a very toxic chemical, and exposure can cause extreme dangers to human health, leading to neurological disorders. Repeated exposure to mercury can lead to symptoms including tremors, irritability, insomnia, confusion, memory loss, slurred speech, coordination problems, weight loss, muscle weakness, headaches, rashes, anxiety, depression, hallucinations, and delusions.
Ooh,
I felt like I was just reading one of those, the pharmacy ads like that
yes.
we see on TV.
That is 100% what I was thinking yeah. too.
I try to do it fast to make it seem like that. But yeah, just a whole slew of problems that can come from mercury exposure. The medical term for Mad Hatter's disease is known as erythism and is somewhat hard to identify as the leading cause to Hatter's odd behaviors. Well, was. Now it's pretty easy to tell that, oh, you got mercury poisoning. But
right.
back in the day, it was kind of hard to identify. Some of the obvious signs of this disease include red fingers, red toes, red cheeks, profuse sweating, loss of hearing, loss of appendages such as teeth, hair, and nails, as well as bleeding from the ears.
Oh my, I don't want any of those side effects. No, that is gnarly. That.
Yes, very gross.
Yuck.
So Johnny Depp's role as the Mad Hatter in 2010 Alice in Wonderland depicted some of these signs and symptoms showing orange hair, orange fingernails, and eyes.
Oh, okay.
That's
that
why
makes
he looks
sense.
So creepy. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely creepy.
Many Hatters would not admit to using mercury in their hat-making process due to the fears of losing their job.
Okay.
The use of mercury, yeah. So the use of mercury in hat making is thought to originate in 17th century France. By this time, the dangers of mercury exposure were already known. However, hatters kept this an industry secret because they believed it made the best hats. While most don't know the reason the job was so dangerous, many people started creating terms around the obviously sick hatters, like mad as a hatter, the Hatter's Shake, and also known as the Danbury Shakes, which referred to the town of Danbury, which was the leading center for hat making in America in the 19th century.
Oh, okay.
There wasn't much published research into Hatter's disease until a paper published in 1860 by Addison Freeman covering mercury poisoning in New Jersey hatters. Alternatives to mercury-based carotid fluid was developed in 1874 and was patented in 1888, but widely ignored by hatters. They just wanted to keep using mercury for whatever reason.
Well, but okay, back then, do you think that they really cared about long-term effects?
Longevity.
Or were they just like, I mean, it's fine, it's not a big deal?
I think I would care once I couldn't stop tremors and I started bleeding from my ears and my fingernails, teeth fell out. I think I'd have a problem with that.
Okay. Valid point. But my guess is when it got to that level, then it was too far gone. So it's the ones who aren't sick that are like, I'm not sick. I'm fine. I'm going to keep doing it because it works better to do it this way, regardless of the fact that I could end up like my coworker who is now bleeding from every orifice.
I don't know. I think once I saw my coworker doing that and he's been in the hat trade for 5 more years than me, I'd be like, okay, I'm done. I don't want to do
yeah.
this anymore. I see where it leads.
Good point.
So
but,
mercury.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be out of there. Mercury was used in the hat-making process in America until around 1941 when it was eventually banned. And that is the origin of Mad Hatter's disease.
Wow. When you were researching this, did you find any crimes that were committed from people suffering from it, that were using it as a defense or as an excuse? Like, I went mad and I did this and
so
murdered my neighborhood.
Researchers have suggested that Boston Corbett, a hat industry worker who killed John Wilkes Booth, may have suffered from Mad Hatter's disease, but it wasn't proven. Okay. So that was like the really only crime I saw associated with it. But he killed the guy who killed Abraham Lincoln, so he's kind of not that bad in my eyes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Modern day Jack Ruby. Or old fashioned Jack Ruby.
Right. But without the LSD.
Yeah. Just mercury.
Yeah. I don't know which one's better.
That's what you got to do to, I guess, kill the assassin of a president is just poison yourself. And then you'd become a crazy person.
I'm good, thanks. I don't need to do that.
Yeah. Oh. Well, do you have a chaser for us?
I do have a chaser, and it is a watch recommendation for the show The Agency on Paramount Plus. It's a CIA crime thriller kind of thing. I have been watching it slowly, episode by episode, and then it finally is over for the season. And of course, it ended on a nice little cliffhanger. So I'm looking forward to the second season, whenever that comes out. But it's a newer show, so I think I'm waiting for season two for a while.
Yeah.
I liked it, though.
Landman. If back to one of my previous chasers, Landman is finally over. So
I know.
Well, season one is over. So season, if you guys were waiting, now's the time to start watching it. They also left on a cliffhanger, but I'm assuming we're not going to see that next episode or next season for a while.
Probably not, which is a sad. Bummer.
I know. I think I'm on my sixth rewatch of it.
Really?
Yeah. Whenever I'm bored, I just put it on and have it as background music.
That's funny. Well, it's a good show.
Yeah.
We enjoyed it. What's your chaser today?
The chaser is also a watch recommendation for it's not brand new, but it's new on Hulu. The movie was originally self-funded and released in certain theaters around the world, or around the country, I should say. But it was recently picked up by Hulu. It was made in 2024. It's called Let's Start a Cult. And I have a feeling our listeners would enjoy it. Oh. It's a comedy movie about a suicide cult that it's a really good watch. It's got a comedian Stavros Halkias, who funded it and is the main character in it. And it's just a really good watch. It's got a bunch of weird people that you would be like, yeah, I could see them being in a cult, but
that's cool.
It's really funny.
And funny enough, I've got a cult episode coming soon. So
Okay. Sweet.
Yeah.
Should have saved it for when you did that, but it came out this week on Hulu, so I wanted to jump on.
You don't know. You don't know my stories and I don't know your stories, so you couldn't have known to wait.
I'm surprised we haven't done an overlapping one yet.
I am too. Well, when you did Teresita Bassa, I thought for sure we had already done it, which technically we had, because we just didn't do it on this channel. I believe we did it on another podcast channel and as a crossover. But
we haven't done it for you guys, so it's new to our listeners.
Exactly. We had not done it for this audience, but it was, there almost every day when you tell me when we're recording and you're like, I'm going to do this, I'm just like, what are we going to do if one of these times we have the same story, or spoiler alert, because we record a couple of them at a time, I'm just waiting for the time when you go, oh, I'm doing this. And I'm like, well, shit, that was my one for next week.
Next week. Yeah. Yeah.
And I've got nothing else to bring.
Fingers crossed. It hasn't happened.
Knock on wood. We have not done that yet. So.
Yes.
All right. I think that wraps us up.
Yeah. Nice little healthy 45-minute episode.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. Once again, everybody, checking us out week by week.
Good tell to all your friends
your story, Mom. Yes, let everyone, you know, share this episode if you like. And leave us a review on Apple. And we'll read it out next week.
For sure.
All right. Love you,
Mom. Love you, bud. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.